Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to the Lob podcast from These Football Times. Another episode in the One Love series, wherein I'm talking with members of the TFT team about that special love in their life, the football club that they support, and why, despite all the heartache inevitably endured, it remains their one love. In this episode, I'm chatting with Alex Ireland. Alex, welcome aboard, buddy.
Oh, thanks for having me.
No worries, pal. So before we start, you better tell me the club, or tell listeners as well, the club who we're going to be talking about today and your affection for.
Well, I think it would attract more pity than it would have done in previous seasons. But yeah, I'm a supporter of Manchester United. And as always with Man United fans, you have to put in that caveat that it is my local professional club and always has been.
It's interesting one. I mean, I understand what you say. I'm a Chelsea fan and I come from Walsall in the West Midlands. And people often say, well, why do you support Chelsea? And I have no idea. I can't remember. I mean, it's 60 odd years ago now. But, you know, people kind of clue me being a glory hunter. I've been supporting Chelsea since, let's say, early 60s. So I've gone through the as well. But there you go. But I know what you're saying, matey. Yeah. So, you know, you don't have to apologise for whoever you support, but it's at. I like the way you say you have to have some sympathy from fans because Man United. I'm sure many non-Man United fans would say, "No, hard luck, buddy, you've suffered."
No, perhaps not, but yeah, comparatively, these have been lean times.
They have indeed. So, okay, do you want to tell us? I mean, you mentioned local. It's your local club. Is it like a family thing that you've gone through, or is it just something you hooked up quite early in life?
Yeah, so I'm from South Manchester. I live about 3 tram stops down from Old Trafford. And my dad used to go in the 60s and 70s as a season ticket before I ruined everything. Interestingly, he went, you know, wasn't a huge kind of, you know, female attendance at games. But he used to go with his aunt. His father died quite young. So he used to go with his aunt. And yeah, then in the 90s, first game was the 92-93 season and gone ever since. You know, uncles on both sides are United supporters, so it was kind of only one choice, really.
Yeah, yeah. Never tempted to be a local. I mean, 3 tram stops away from Old Trafford, you couldn't get much more local than that, in fairness, buddy, could you?
No, absolutely, yeah. And I've always lived in the same part of Manchester, you know, moved away for university for 3 years, but yeah, never strayed too far from Old Trafford.
Okay, well, let's get the ball out and have a kick about a bit. So I want to ask you a few questions about the club and your sort of feelings and opinions about past and future and present and such like. So first question is, the best player, not necessarily your favourite player, but the best player ever to play for Manchester United?
I mean, very lucky to have a very good selection. I think it's very hard to narrow it down to one. I'd say probably 3, if you don't mind. I think, you know, Cantona, obviously, just his influence on a team, sort of pushing us initially over the line to win the title the first time. And I think it's underestimated, you know, perhaps because assists didn't have the same statistical merit as they do nowadays. But if you do look with kind of modern eyes, it's something like 0.8 goals and assists per game in you know, not a necessarily free scoring team all the time. And so I think that combination of the kind of inspiration, motivation and sort of productivity is unmatched. And then I think Keane, looking in midfield, you know, Keane, and somebody who really transitioned during his time with us, you know, came to us as a kind of barnstorming, goal-scoring midfielder, the kind of heir apparent to Brian Robson, who was fading. And I never really saw the best of, you know, we saw him as really he was kind of the occasional sub-appearance. And then like in parallel with the team that was very naive in the first years that we were competing in Europe, in the early 90s, you know, matured so much and became a real kind of orchestrator of games and, you know, such a kind of cultured player, so intelligent and really kind of knitted the midfield together. And then there's loads of attackers, you know, you could have Giggs, you could have Rooney, but I think Ronaldo, it was probably the third, Cristiano Ronaldo, from this kind of callow box of tricks to just an absolutely kind of devastating force of nature by the time he left. And I think maybe that's been tempered people's memory of him because he became this ultra efficient poacher. That's maybe the residual image for people. But, you know, if your memory has faded of him, if you have looked back to sort of 2006 to 2008, you know, just such a destructive force and often picking the ball up from halfway and, you know, these sort of howitzer shots from 25 or 30 yards, you know, he was, yeah, just totally destructive and very ably supported by Rooney and Tevez, who were great foils for him. And I think in terms of a combination, probably those three are about as terrifying. You know, you can imagine as a defender, it's not only the skill and the pace and the physicality, but just sort of the tenacity and hard work that, you know, they were, I think, probably the best front line in my generation and perhaps since the best Charlton and Law days.
It's interesting you mention Manchester United has such a rich history. You know, I'm old enough to remember the high days of Bobby Charlton, George Best, and Dennis Law, you mentioned earlier, and, you know, other players around that sort of era. That, I mean, you know, it's so difficult if you haven't seen them in real life. So, you know, I absolutely take on board what you're saying about Cantona. I've got a daughter who's a Manchester United fan, and she would be Cantona as well. I mean, it's one of those players that actually transforms a club. You know, from not only the team but the club, and brought a sort of different mentalities to the play. And yeah, Cantona is one of those sort of iconic Manchester United players of all time, isn't he? Okay, so this I'll put this question after I sort of reviewed what I was going to ask before I set the series up, because the answer to this question might not necessarily be the same as the answer to the previous question, although it might be. So, favourite player?
Very difficult. There are very few that I dislike. And often it was the youth players. I mean, even people like Jonathan Spector, remember, you know, and the likes of Darren Fletcher and other people are really liked. I think probably one that I disproportionately like the most, maybe compared to most United fans, Patrice Evra. And perhaps this is being a jobbing left back in the Manchester Saturday and Sunday leagues for 20 years. But I think one thing that really... He seemed, at least for a couple of seasons, to have such one of these players that had such an impact on the game, you know, especially from left back, that especially when you're at the game, you just sort of feel some players having an undue influence, you know, more than a kind of 1 in 22 influence on the game. And he really felt like that, you know, in an attacking sense and as a good defender as well, you know, really, really fond of him.
Yeah, that's a good call. You know, when I asked this question previous episodes, there's been a little bit of discussion about who they would choose, but I think this one's going to be a bit of a sort of no-brainer. Best manager?
I think it goes without saying, doesn't it? Yeah, we're so lucky and personally so lucky that just by coincidence, I mean, I remember watching the Cup Winners' Cup final in 91 on television, had a couple of other memories of other games, but I didn't start going to the 92-93 season. And really, you've just kind of known almost unending success for the first two decades as a match attending fan. And Fergie was at the part of it. But it also sort of shows the entitlement of fans. Even this isn't a modern, you know, particularly modern invention, that you there were two or three points even during that successful period, you know, perhaps around sort of 2000 or 2002 or so, where there were really loud murmurs. You go to the game and a lot of criticism, and in hindsight, it just seems ludicrous given what he's done, but just sort of shows you that as fans, we're really never satisfied.
Absolutely right, mate, yeah. My son is a Chelsea fan, was born in 87, so his football sort of awakening was just at the start of Abramovich, so he's never known anything but success. And my daughter's very similar, so my daughter's 40 now, so she was very much grew up in the Ferguson successor era. So it's all about being born at the right time, isn't it? I mean, Chelsea, when my team won the league in 1954, the year before I was born, and I had to wait for the 50 years for another one. So it's all about life, it's all about timing. And yeah, Alex Ferguson, obviously, you know, certainly in the modern era of Manchester United, means a little bit older, I might say Busby, but it's difficult to say Ferguson wasn't the, you know, the outstanding manager for Manchester United. Just so, I mean, I changed the way I phrase these next questions, because I originally put the worst player, but I don't mean the worst player. What I'm saying, the most frustrating and disappointing player.
Absolutely no shadow of a doubt, Paul Pogba. Absolutely, there's no comparison. Probably in the far distance, there's Juan Sebastian Veron, but I mean, probably, and this is probably going to get me cancelled by United fans, but if I could watch a United player on his game, it might be Pogba that I'd choose out of all of them that I've ever watched. You know, he absolutely had everything kind of technically and physically. And, you know, he could pass off both feet, could score free kicks, he could score from long range, he had very sort of tricky dribbling, all in this sort of 6 foot four stacked frame. You know, he was incredible. And I think the most, you know, some of the most interesting things were like this combination of like physicality and skill, which is just, I think, really unrivaled, that, you know, the ball would be punted up to him or arrive and he would just, any other player would sort of flick the header on or something like that, and he would just take the ball down with absolutely no regard and kind of no respect for the players around him. You know, and it wasn't, there were many elements of him that were arrogant, but it was just that kind of supreme confidence that you have the technical and physical ability to dominate any player. But for whatever reason, him, the club at the time, how he was used, his own performance, it just, it would be one in 10, one in 15 games where he'd really show what he could do. But he's an extraordinary, extraordinary talented player. I think very few have been born with more gifts than he has. And if you look in hindsight, apart from that really good period at Juventus and, you know, some good times with France, a lot of his club career has really been squandered.
Yeah, that's a really good pick, actually. As in disappointing and frustrating. I mean, you could almost look in the dictionary for that and find a picture of Paul Pogba there. The talent,
he is joyful.
You say.
I mean, he is, you know, he is the most joyful of players when you could finally get him on form. You know, again, dribble, shooting, physicality, he's just wonderful.
Yeah, the World Cup in France, when they beat, especially when they beat was Croatia in the final, I mean, he was just like a mountain, an absolute giant stride across the pitch in total control of the game, which shows all the things he could have done and should have done, perhaps. And it's interesting, I mean, it was when Ferguson let him go quite early in his career, and a lot of people said it was a mistake. Well, as it happens, it probably wasn't in the long run, because, as you say, all the talent, but there's no point having all the talent if it's not on display. So, yeah, it's a great pick. Same question about a manager. So, most frustrating or disappointing manager?
They're lining up recently. I suppose Mourinho, perhaps, that we got Mourinho on the way down, that you think Pete Mourinho is one of probably the few managers with the, if he'd replaced Ferguson directly, you know, he might have been able to kind of maintain that success. One of the with the kind of gravitas and character and medals to convince even the most unwilling of trainers or workers to do something. So, you know, we had a good season the first season, but then he was sort of in his more irascible, irritable phase and quickly fell out with a lot of the players, and it as it's done at sort of every club, unfortunately, since that first Chelsea period, it just crumbled.
It's interesting, say, if you'd have followed Ferguson. I mean, our obviously David Moyes was, apparently was Ferguson's choice to take over. The question is, you don't really ever, do you ever want to be the man who follows the man? You're always going to live in the shadow unless you can excel, and it would have been difficult for anybody to excel, to match, let alone excel what Ferguson has done. So I always think when David Moyes, I mean, he did well at Everton, but the difference between Everton in those days and Manchester United in those days are, you know, 3.5 million miles apart, aren't they?
I do understand that you know, they wanted to look for the closest parallel to Ferguson, and at the time, you know, it's very easy to look back with, you know, 2020 hindsight, but, you know, he'd shown he could manage a club, that he could bring through young players. You know, he did make some good signings on a limited budget, the likes of Arteta, Julian Lescott, Cahill. You know, he ran things like a club, and he's probably the closest model to Ferguson of somebody who's familiar with the English league. And so, again, in hindsight, it was a mistake, but I sort of understand the reasoning behind it, that Ferguson and the others wanted to perpetuate that model that probably even then was becoming a bit outdated, of one man kind of overseeing every aspect of the club. It is a shame that it just appeared beyond him. You know, he's shown since that he's a good manager. You look at his record as a career as a whole, without perhaps being outstanding, but it's a shame that he just couldn't seem to rise to that extra level.
Yeah, I always think with Ferguson and perhaps to a similar extent with Wenger, the role and the tenure of managers of English clubs has been massively distorted. I mean, I'm living in Spain on the continent here. Any club that keeps a manager for more than 3 years is massively exceptional. It just hardly happens. And yet here we had guys who Ferguson was, for what, I don't know, 20-odd years or Craig. It seemed like 30, 40, 50 years, and every year they were winning trophies and Wenger to some extent as well. And it just sort of, it almost made it, as I mentioned earlier, to even match the dynamics of what Ferguson done, it almost made it an impossible task for anybody. And there's lots of managers who have come in since. And, I mean, you can't, it's impossible to measure against Ferguson because you're always going to come up short, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also one of his best attributes was his humility, in the sense of he knew what he couldn't do, and also his ability to adapt. That I think when comparison to somebody like Wenger, who's put forward, and quite rightly, as somebody who brought the game forward, that Ferguson was very, very forward thinking. You know, so things like in the mid-90s, he had a vision specialist, Professor Gail Stevenson, who did vision training to kind of improve the peripheral vision of play. So he's taking on these sort of aspects of sports science and things like that. You know, he was one of the, if we could call really, innovators of sort of that use of the squad of rotating players, which is obviously, you know, absolutely every club, you know, even in second, third tier, perhaps do that now. But he also had that humility to say that I'm not a fantastic coach. You know, I had a great knowledge of the game and good sort of tactical insights. But, you know, he brought from having had Brian Kidd, he brought in Steve McLaren, who was a young, very well thought of coach. And he would sort of handle that. And then he looked to Carlos Queiroz and to others to provide as the team evolved. You know, we went from that 4-4-2 to having sort of somebody dropping in behind Van Nistelrooy to that sort of 4-3-3, really kind of evolved and became much smarter, particularly in Europe. And I think, yeah, that humility to ever keep changing. And by the end, it is sort of finesse, this sort of alchemy. It was like a fine art. You know, the combinations like buddy Raphael and Giggs in centre midfield, and it just sort of seemed whoever he would put anywhere, he could just produce, you know, a fantastic result. And yeah, I think that evolution, that humility, that kind of working with other people and recognizing his strengths and his limitations was really unrivaled.
Yeah, I'm going to pose something to you now. I mean, I don't want this to turn into a Ferguson fest, but I mean, he's such a dominant figure across Manchester United recent history. So I think it's important we sort of, you know, get the ball out of a kick about with him. And when Matt Busby retired as manager, he stayed on as like this father figure, and all the managers followed were sort of under the gaze of him, and it seemed they never had that freedom to be themselves. And well, that's a good or a bad thing. It's just a true thing. And I think with Ferguson, because obviously he became a director or something after he left the manager's role, but he's still there. Would it have been easier or less difficult, shall we say, for the guys following Ferguson if he'd had a clean break, for want of a better description? I'm not sure that it would ever have been possible, because Manchester United was obviously in his blood, it was in his soul. But, you know, do you think it had been less difficult for the guys succeeding him if the shadow of Ferguson wasn't over the new guys?
Perhaps, yeah. But I think it was unlikely, as somebody who lived, you know, he lives in I think, Wilmslow, which is, you know, 8-10 miles from Old Trafford. The idea of him never going to see the club that he'd fallen in love with again. And it was, I think it was a slightly different thing. I think Matt Busby retained his office even after he'd left, and he was a figure that kind of loomed large. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose that kind of living ghost hangs around. And but he's been very, very quiet. I don't think he's said a lot in the media. He's not, you know, saying supportive things, you know, and he was very, very clear. You know, his last words almost to the United fans were to, you know, stand by David Moyes. So I think the sort of spectre of Busby loomed a lot larger. And, you know, from what you read, this is something that Ferguson did have doubts in his own abilities, you know, particularly in the 90s when we came so close so many times, but he couldn't emulate what Samat had done and win the European Cup. And I think, you know, there was a really nice documentary recently on Prime about this, and sort of you know, talked very openly about, you know, have I got the, it was talking about whether he had the capacity to become that, you know, to go that next step and be a manager who could compete in the European Cup, which is sort of ludicrous when you think about what he did at Aberdeen and then also, you know, having won a European trophy. But I think for him, that spectre definitely kind of weighed. But I assume that Ferguson has been very supportive behind the scenes. You know, he is somebody very well known, you know, amongst the manager. People like Sam Allardyce, you know, have said how much of a help he's been throughout their careers, even when they were sort of quite rivals, but competing in the Premier League together. And Ferguson in turn has said that Bobby Charlton was, you know, a real kind of source of support through the dark part of the 80s where it wasn't clicking at first. So, yeah, if Ferguson wasn't there or around, maybe it would be a little easier, but perhaps it hasn't weighed as heavy as Samat's presence did.
Yeah, it's a good comparison, good call. Okay, we're going into what I call the Dickensian sector now. So the first thing is the best of times.
I suppose two periods. 1999 is very cliched, but it was just an extraordinary team, extraordinary character, you know, the matches, and culminating with Barcelona and the last minute victory. But it was a wonderful team that was, it wasn't all sort of smooth sailing. We had sort of bad periods. We'd lost the league the previous season. There was a lot of pressure on Ferguson. Schmeichel was very much coming to the end of his career. You know, there were doubts about other players. So he'd bloodied this, likes Beckham and Scholes and so on. And he'd obviously proved that they could be competitive in the Premier League. But did they have it to emulate Charlton and Best as those homegrown players who could compete with at the very highest level? And just showed resoundingly that they could. I mean, again, a very sort of red-tinted glasses, but I don't think there were many better players in the world than Beckham that season and around that period. You know, he's extraordinary sort of creative talent and, you know, very hardworking as well. So that team was magnificent. Almost every player, you know, likes of Stam, Giggs, Keane, Scholes, the York and Cole partnership, even Schmeichel, Gary Neville, wonderful team. It's very hard because in my time, there've been probably three good teams. That there was the first title winning team with Ince, Keane in midfield, Kanchelskis, Giggs, Hughes, Cantona, etc. And then there's that second really excellent team. And then probably the third one is the 2008 side. And I it sounds again like heresy, but I think that 2008 side might just pip it as my favourite United side. I just thought they were absolutely wonderful. Like, and yeah, just full of character, full of invention, youth. You know, it was just an absolute joy to watch. And but all three of those teams, you know, been kind of a privilege to spectate on.
Fair call. Flip the coin over now. The worst of times.
I suppose the last few years. I think, you know, I went to a game where Liverpool beat us 5-0 at home, and I suppose the worst moment of that was we got this Ollie's at the Wheel song, which had become a real kind of fan's favourite. And it was, you know, it was really enthusiastically sung, you know, being a Stone Roses hit as well. That was great. And it became a firm favourite. And it was destroyed in one half of football when the Liverpool fans started singing and you know, Ollie's at the Wheel. And we've not really heard it since. So, you know, that's a particular moment. But I think just the last few years, you know, it was absolutely miserable during Ranić when I don't think any great fault to him, but it was just a disaster. And I think just generally just this idea that there's no real faith from United fans, probably this season, that I think every season we've had that unjustified optimism that somehow we will be top two or three. And I think this is the first season I can think of really where there's been no hope or expectation, and we've spent so much money on players that haven't worked out, and we've gone through different managers now that we just don't see where we're going to bridge that gap to City and Liverpool. I mean, we've been playing you know, there's been some better football, but still not scored a lot of goals this season. So, yeah, again, no doubt fans in the very lower reaches of the League One, League Two and below will have the tiniest violin out for me. But, yeah, the last few years have not been much fun.
Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying. And, you know, it's I would say when with a fan of any club, success is relative. If you're in, you're supporting a team in the Evo Stick North Division South Third Tier, something or other, you know, and getting promotion or not getting relegated is probably no less joyful than, you know, I would say at top club and whatever Premier League winning the league or winning the Euro, and it's just as worthy. And it doesn't really matter. And the disappointment is exactly the same as well. So, you know, I think, you know, where you are and the aspiration to achieve something or disappoint when you don't is sort of is the same, regardless of almost any level you're at. Yeah, it's a fair comment. So how are they doing now? I know we've sort of, you've sort of covered a little bit, but sort of, you know, if you're going to take a snapshot of Manchester United in this sort of period, perhaps this season, turn of last season, and you're explaining to somebody who doesn't know, how would you describe where you are now?
It's just, I think, this sort of no man's land of we're probably 6 to 8 team. We're much less than some of our parts because Rashford does have a habit of coming in and out of form. But, you know, somebody who 15 months ago had scored 31 goals in a season, Bruno Fernandes has been the most creative player in Europe since he arrived. De Ligt, obviously, you know, captain of Ajax at 17. Luke Shaw, excellent for England. The players are there, but it just doesn't knit together, and it's hard to know what it is. So it just continues this kind of curse against it that we don't seem to be able to find the right combination, and it's very difficult to know as well where to go. Maybe this is sort of, again, with hindsight, but, you know, you could look back to the likes of Ancelotti and Hiddink, and there seem to be sort of some bona fide, sure thing managers that would do a job for you. And there probably aren't, you know, other than ones that are connected to our rivals like Guardiola and Klopp. So it's difficult to know what's going to happen. I suppose the only bright spark is we have got a very young generation of players that are starting to come through, and we've seen some of them. There's maybe four or five that might come through to be first team players. It's, I think, the best generation we've had since 92-93. There's some really excellent players, and for me, again, probably as part of the left back union, Harry Amass, you know, watch out for him. If we don't make him into a football player, there's something gone very wrong, because sort of a Luke Shaw clone, maybe, but maybe a little more skillful. He's a wonderful player, but that's probably the only bright spark. And, you know, he's sort of Toba Collier coming in, Ethan Wheatley. We've got a good Czech goalkeeper as well. So, yeah, there's maybe 4, 5, 6 that, if we're doing things right. Shea Lacey's been unfortunate with injuries. We've had Dangor had a recent injury, but there's a lot of talent. And that's probably what we're clinging on to at the moment. And then I suppose the final thing is this, you know, very important. It's off the field, but Old Trafford, you know, regeneration and what we're going to do about that. And we have fallen behind. And I suppose you don't notice it because it's almost like home. You know, it is a bit embarrassing when the rain pours and the stadium flops. And by comparison, it is very, very outdated. But it's, you know, you obviously, it feels like almost the same stadium that I've been going to for 30 years. And, you know, there are elements of it that are still there from its redesign sort of 80 or 90 years ago, the original tunnel at the middle of the pitch. So it'd be interesting to see what happens to that. You know, the idea of it just becoming some sort of soulless bowl is difficult, but, you know, times change and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mentioned earlier that my daughter's a Man United fan, and she's been banging on about Man U to me for a long time. And I've done some Man United football, but living over here in Spain, and I was so impressed with the kid in the European Championship, and he looks like a real star in the making. So, yeah, you mentioned a lot of young players there coming through. So penultimate question is, where will Manchester United be within 5 to 10 years?
Let's be optimistic. I think if you have a... You know, we have a new stadium, by that point, say 10 years. You know, it's a horrible, brutal reality of football, but the teams that spend more money win things, and United, I can't see that kind of financial gap being bridged. We're eventually getting the Glazers out, so I think there'll be, you know, rather than the monstrous income that we make being siphoned off, it can then be used to improve the team. Not that we've not spent a decent amount of money, but just not spent it wisely. But yeah, hopeful this Brains Trust means that we'll go back to where we were, you know, being competitive with Liverpool and you know, adding to that 20 league titles.
Okay, buddy. So this is the final question, and it's one that, you know, I think we all know the answer to already, but here we go. Could anything make you change your club allegiance? Are you thinking about this one? This is interesting. You're thinking about it.
Yeah, I trying to give you an honest answer. I don't know. I suppose, you know, I suppose the ownership issue and kind of what those things stand for, that would be something. I think if we did leave and join a Super League, you know, if we did start playing games in the USA, you know, it feels football's very vulnerable at the moment. And, you know, it could be that, you know, it's within people's power that an owner comes in and effectively sort of takes the thing away from where it was. You've got a lot of American owners. There's, you know, obviously American sport has a history of these franchises. And if you have 17, 18 American owners, they have the right to vote together as part of the Premier League. And, you know, they've shown with the likes of Super League, the likes of what they've done in terms of increasing ticket prices, removing support for disabled fans and other things like that, that really the hardcore fan base is of little or no concern to them. So I think there are, it'd be very hard, but there are, I think it speaks more to sort of the general disillusionment with football that, you know, if things like the Super League or other things that threaten integrity of football were to come to pass, then I think it'd probably be leaving football altogether, really.
Actually, astonishingly frank and honest answer, Alex, there. So, you know, thanks for that, buddy. It's the easy Pat Andrew say, oh, no, it'll always be my club. But thanks for that. That's great. But that just rounds it off. So I'll just say a massive thanks to Alex there for your contribution, talking to us about your one love club, Manchester United. So thanks, buddy.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Not a problem. Okay, so that rounds up the episode for today. Catch you next time on the Love Podcast from These Football Times, and look out for the next episode of the One Love Series.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Love, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.